the peace that you are seeking, you have a part to play in it. Even if we bring 5,000 troops from Nigeria, without the support domestically from Liberians, things are not going to be that easy.
The Joint Intelligence Committee of Congress has relevant information dealing with Saudi money laundering and Saudi furtherance of 9/11.
Their cells were destroyed by radiation from plutonium and strontium, and their flesh simply deteriorated.
And so it concentrates the strontium 90 most highly in human breast milk. So years later, 10, 20, 30 years later, that person may develop a bone cancer like Teddy Kennedy's son did.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, August 7th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. West African peacekeeping forces drove into Liberia's rebel-besieged famished capital today to deafening cheers from the city's people. The triumphant arrival came as President Charles Taylor announced his successor, a step toward his much-anticipated resignation and toward ending 2 months of bloody warfare in Monrovia that has killed at least 1,000 people. A car bomb shattered a street outside the walled Jordanian embassy today, killing at least 11 people, including two children, in an attack that raised concerns that Iraq's violence could be broadening from a resistance to the U.S. occupation toward a terrorist insurgency. More than 50 people were wounded by the explosion, which set cars on fire, flung the hulk of one vehicle onto a rooftop, and broke windows hundreds of yards away. Saddam Hussein has been forced to move at least three times a day because of mounting raids by U.S. forces on sites where soldiers have found evidence that someone important, perhaps the ousted Iraqi leader himself, had been hiding. That's according to a U.S. general. As the raids eat away at Saddam's support network, it has become increasingly difficult for guerrilla leaders to find foot soldiers willing to attack U.S. forces, driving the amount paid for a successful attack as high as $5,000 from $1,000. That's according to Major General Ray Odinero, commander of the 4th Infantry Division, citing Army intelligence. The Pentagon admitted yesterday that it's unable to explain a deadly form of pneumonia spreading quickly among U.S. troops serving in and around Iraq. About 100 soldiers have contracted the illness so far, which has caused 2 deaths and 15 serious illnesses requiring the support of a ventilator. Theories have abounded as to whether the pneumonia might be tied to the anthrax vaccine or is a new version of the still unexplained Gulf War syndrome that's been responsible for the deaths of over 10,000 veterans of the first Gulf War. Now, two more soldiers who just returned from Operation Iraqi Freedom have died due to Gulf War syndrome. Both are said to have died from mysterious circumstances attributed to a, quote, unknown toxin, unquote. Jerry Quickly of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke recently with registered nurse Joyce Riley about the circumstances surrounding the recent deaths of these two soldiers.
It's real sad what is happening. We have got Gulf War II veterans that are dying. Now, I realize there's only two of them, but what you may not know is that though these two have died who were in excellent health, there are another at least 17 to 30 that we suspect are very, very sick at this time. Now, let me back up and say that on about the 8th of July, Josh Nushi went on a mission. Now, this is a young man who was extremely popular in his high school. He was best liked, prom king. I mean, you name it, this was a popular kid. Never been to a doctor, very healthy. He had been going to Southwest Missouri State University and was called up because of his involvement in the National Guard. He went to Iraq and wrote to his parents that on July 8th, he was going to be involved in a mission. It was called a hauling mission, H-A-U-L-I-N-G. It was a classified hauling mission. Well, what we now have learned is, and I've learned this from his parents in meeting with his parents, that he was at the Baghdad airport, at which time he came into contact with some type of toxin. Now, obviously, he was not the only one, and yet he became the first to become ill. They then air-evac'd him out of Baghdad to Landstuhl, Germany, told his parents that they needed to get to Landstuhl, Germany. They didn't have any money, couldn't do it, and so the men in his unit took up a donation and a collection to get his parents over there to see him. When they arrived, he was in a room in which they had to have full coverage gear on them, and they were not allowed to touch him other than through the gear. Well, at that time, he was not conscious. They then transferred him as his muscles began to break down and his organs began to break down. I mean, we're talking about a serious toxin. And they then decided that he was going to need to be dialyzed because of his renal kidney failure. So they took him by ambulance over to Hamburg Hospital, and he died on the way to Hamburg Hospital. When the parents got there, they were told that their son had come down with pneumonia. Now, you can imagine in the Iraqi desert, that's probably a little bit difficult to do.
Yeah.
And his lungs were filling up with fluid and his kidneys were failing. Then, of course, all the other organs began to fail. After he died, the family went back to Landstuhl at the room where he was to get his belongings. And everything had been quarantined and they were not allowed to go in that room. So they began asking some questions, and lo and behold, about 20 to 30 other young men came into Landstuhl Hospital in almost the same condition or for the same reason, they said. Now, they were told that this was some type of toxin that had hit them. Now, think about this. You know that when we have two dead crows in New York City that die of West Nile, everybody knows about it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Or if there's some chickens that get some disease over in
Hong Kong, or
you name it.
Right.
Then the World Health Organization is on it in a heartbeat, and Dr. Julie Gerberding from the CDC is announcing it, that we've had four cases, therefore this might be an epidemic. What I'm saying is they can make it known. Now we've got between 15 and 30 guys that are extremely ill, that many of them may be on respirators right now, and yet you're not hearing a word about this. Coincidentally, at the same time of this, we have on the 17th of July, we have the president giving the address with Blair, with Tony Blair, at which time he either made a slip or a major mistake. And I don't know if you noticed this or not, but we got the transcript at first, and then we got the actual clip from the speech. He makes a slip in which he says, "We will bring the weapons."
I believe that we will find the truth, and the truth is he was developing a program for weapons of mass destruction. Now, you say, why didn't it happen all of a sudden? Well, there was a lot of chaos in the country. One. Two, Saddam Hussein has spent over a decade hiding weapons and hiding materials. Three, we're just beginning to get some cooperation from some of the high-level officials in that administration or that regime. We will bring the weapons, and of course, we will bring the information forward on the weapons when they find them. And that'll end all this speculation.
Now, did you hear that statement?
I heard
That's
it.
Right.
I
now,
heard
here
him,
it
heard
is.
Him say it.
It's incredible. It's incredible. It's in the transcript. Play the clip, the second clip now. This clip is where it's more, it's going to say, we will bring the weapons.
We will bring the weapons.
That's it. We will bring the weapons.
Yeah, we will bring the weapons.
Promised, as you heard on tape, to bring the weapons. And we have this group of soldiers now who have become lethally ill, who have died from this unknown toxin on these secret hauling missions. God knows what it is they're hauling, and God knows what it is that they're putting into place. Maybe these soldiers are on missions where they're hauling toxic materials to be put into place to be found by other U.S. soldiers so George Bush can finally say, "See, I told you we found the weapons." Because if in fact these troops were being harmed by these toxic weapons and they were Iraqi weapons, George Bush would already be shouting it from the highest rafters. I told you these filthy Iraqis had these weapons, and I've finally proven it. Now get off my back and let me go back to my PlayStation. That's what he'd be saying if they actually found the weapons, but they haven't found the weapons, but they're promising to bring the weapons, and you have U.S. troops mysteriously getting ill, getting very sick, in some cases dying, and ending up in complete isolation in hospitals in Germany, and the administration won't even pay their families to come visit them and see them in their weakened and ill condition.
Well, you know, it's interesting also, I went to meet with the family, and they said that they were able to get someone who was able to get access to the medical records to which there was no mention of pneumonia whatsoever in the medical record. Though I don't know what was in it, that we do know there was no mention of pneumonia. So the question is, what were they hauling, number one? Now, his MOS, his military specialty in the Army, was heavy equipment operator. So we don't know what he was hauling. The family has not been told anything. They're highly suspicious. They've been very verbal, and you have not heard a word about this on the national news. So I think it's surprising that we have 30 to 40 people that may be on respirators at this point in time from a toxin, and not a word is leaking out. The question also of why they were at Baghdad Airport. Could it have been that they were, in fact, receiving weapons? Now, I'm not making the leap, but I think we are being lied to so many times. I mean, you can just count the ways. There's more to this story, obviously. We're not being told the answers. The family's not being told the truth. And I went to the funeral home and watched as they had bodyguards from the military for him, which was, you know, nice military protocol. But as soon as generals started to arrive, I couldn't take it. I really couldn't, because the sorrow that these people were going through was just immense. And the fact that they don't have any answers.
What's the next step in this process? Are you following up on other leads?
We're just now starting to get responses from those that are returning. And I will tell you, there's a whole lot more going on in Iraq than we can even imagine right now.
Registered nurse Joyce Riley speaking with Jerry Quickly on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Thanks to Christine Blasdale and Fidel Rodriguez for production assistance with that piece. A public interest group that investigates and prosecutes government corruption and abuse intervened in a massive lawsuit to seek incriminating documents regarding Saudi Arabia. The suit filed by Judicial Watch alleges, among other things, that the Saudi royal family, Saudi individuals, and corporate entities may have helped to support terrorism, specifically the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Peace Watch editor Lona Elias spoke today with Larry Klayman, general counsel of Judicial Watch, about the suit pending in the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia and why they chose to intervene at this time.
Judicial Watch represents a victim of 9/11, a gentleman whose wife was killed in the Second World Trade Tower. And we know, not just from published reports, but also from our own clients, some of them, that Saudi Arabia was involved, at least in terms of financing money to further these kinds of acts. So we brought a lawsuit in the District of Columbia. There is a companion lawsuit brought by some other victims. The judge recently ordered that the two suits could, in effect, be merged, and that's why we're intervening in this lawsuit. And, of course, the information which is in the recently released 9/11 report of the Joint Intelligence Committee of Congress has relevant information dealing with Saudi money laundering and Saudi furtherance of 9/11. So we're seeking those documents, and not just for our clients, but also in the public interest, because the American people have a right to know what our government knows about Saudi Arabian involvement in terrorism. It's a very large involvement. And I would submit that one of the reasons that this information continues to be covered up is because of very powerful oil interests in this country that have dealings with Saudi Arabia. The president's father works for a group called Carlyle Group, which has a lot of business in Saudi Arabia. We're not saying that he did anything wrong, but this is part of the reason why we always bend over to Saudi Arabia.
You know for a fact, you have evidence that they were indeed involved in financing?
Yes, we have evidence to that effect.
A press release that was issued by your organization today states that the decision to permit you to be a party to the pending suit clears the way for Judicial Watch to subpoena the 28 pages that were redacted from that recent Congressional Intelligence Report. Those who have read this still classified section of the report say that there are passages in question that show that senior Saudi officials funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to charitable groups and other organizations that may have helped finance the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. What do you think are the realistic chances that you will actually be able to gain access to those redacted pages?
I think they're quite significant. It's going to be a fight. The U.S. government is going to put up the biggest battle it can, because the politicians, the fat cats, Democrats and Republicans, are protecting their vested interests in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. But we're going to get it, and we can get it from other sources. For instance, we represent an active FBI agent out of the Chicago field office. His partner currently works for Judicial Watch, runs our Chicago field office, who can tell you that it's been known for a long time that Saudi Arabia was involved in money laundering in this country. And I'll tell you another interesting fact is that our Internal Revenue Service spent the 1990s auditing all conservative groups because Bill Clinton was in office. There was an IRS commissioner named Charles Rosati who was very happy to do that. He now works for that Carlyle group that I'm talking about that does business in Saudi Arabia. Did he lay off of these Islamic money laundering charities because he wanted a job with the Carlyle group eventually? Perhaps. And that's something we're going to be looking at, too. That'll be another case.
Mr. Clayman, on another but sort of related topic, your group recently received documents as a result of the Freedom of Information Act that revealed that an energy task force led by Vice President Dick Cheney was examining Iraq's oil assets 2 years before the latest war began. Can you talk about the specifics of the information that was...
Yes, these were maps that came out of the Department of Commerce of Iraqi oil fields, also Saudi oil fields, so you can see the symmetry there. And apparently, U.S. oil companies were concerned that European oil companies, they called them suitors, had access to those oil fields. This occurred in March of 2001, well before 9/11. And, you know, in terms of what this means, it can mean a number of different things. But I do believe that it's a valid consideration with regard to Iraq, that you had a madman sitting on top of the second biggest oil supply in the world. It's ironic and perhaps not politically correct, but I would submit that probably our reason for going into Iraq, in addition to looking for weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, since it took us a year to do it, was because of that oil. We have secured the second biggest oil supply in the world, and that's not bad. I don't think that's something negative. It's probably something positive.
Judicial Watch originally filed this Freedom of Information request as part of an investigation into the influence of major party benefactors like Enron Corporation in developing in developing the administration's energy policy. So I take it that it wasn't the sort of information that you kind of like expected to uncover or not?
No, actually, we expected that because I've always said that our energy policy is tied to the war on terrorism. There's no doubt about it. It is a national security interest. It's integrally related because energy, of course, comes from the Middle East. That's where most terrorism comes from. And it has influenced the way we've reacted for or against certain countries. So, yes, there's more of that. And early on, we uncovered a document from Chevron Oil Company asking the administration to relax its restrictions on doing business with the terrorist state of Libya. So stay tuned. There's more to come and more surprises. And we're going to get to the truth of it. We're not here to take a position one way or the other on what energy policy should be. We just want the American people to have all the facts, to have the sun shine in on this Cheney administration, which is very, very secretive.
Coupled with other information that shows that the influential conservative think tank, the Project for a New American Century, planned the war in Iraq years in advance. And, you know, and the U.S.'s inability to find any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was supposedly the reason that we went into this war.
Well, one of the things that we found, not just to be even-handed, you don't have to be even-handed necessarily in Washington, but we found not only oil companies, but also environmental groups trying to get their hands into the cookie jar when it came to administration policy. The oil groups went to the Energy Department and to the Commerce Department. The environmental groups went over to the Environmental Protection Agency with Christy Todd Whitman, and they were all trying to influence the administration. And many interests, and I'm not saying all that I've just mentioned, but many make large contributions to both political parties. So we want to see whether the money influenced the energy policy, and number one. And number two, we want to find out what the unspoken energy policy is. Did we go into Iraq because of oil? Did we go into Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction? That's just one issue. So there are many other issues that are out there.
Now, you mentioned that the war on terrorism and our need for energy are somehow linked or tied. I don't want to misquote you.
It is. I'm talking as Larry Clayman personally.
Okay.
Not in terms of what Judicial Watch is trying to do, but I firmly believe that the Middle East is so volatile that it could blow up at any moment. And if it does, and we lose, for instance, a major oil supplier like Iraq, this could bring Europe and Asia and the rest of the world. We're fairly energy independent when it comes to petroleum here in this country. But it could bring them to their knees, and it could result in a worldwide economic recession. And I personally believe that it is a valid consideration in terms of overthrowing Saddam Hussein when you have a lunatic like that that has the fate of the Western world, the industrialized world, in his hands. Couple that with weapons of mass destruction, and I can make a very strong case for invading Iraq.
Larry Klayman is the chairman and general counsel of Judicial Watch, a public interest group that investigates and prosecutes government corruption and abuse. He spoke with Peace Watch editor Lona Elias. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Again, our website is www.pacifica.org. Thank you for listening and thanks for your support. Earlier this week, Nigerian troops began landing in the capital city of Monrovia, Liberia. A coalition of concerned Liberians met in Washington, D.C. last week to discuss a comprehensive, all-inclusive peace process to resolve conflicts in the war-torn country. His Excellency Augustine Agada, the Nigerian Deputy Ambassador to the U.S., addressed the audience and then took questions from the audience. Agada begins by explaining why Nigeria has offered asylum to Liberian President Charles Taylor.
Another issue that is deserving of mention in this discussion is Nigeria's offer of asylum to President Taylor. Informed public opinion at this time acknowledges that President Taylor's continued stay in Liberia has become an obstacle to finding lasting peace formula in the country. Nigeria has offered to grant asylum to President Taylor so that his continued stay in the country does not become incompatible with the efforts to find peace and reduce the misery of the ordinary citizens of your country. Unfortunately, this noble gesture is being misread and misinterpreted in some circles. Some even thinking that Nigeria is seeking to protect Taylor from the jurisdiction of the War Crimes Tribunal in Sierra Leone. That is far from the truth. What Nigeria has offered President Taylor is asylum. The issue of the tribunal's interest in him is another matter which has no bearing whatsoever in Nigeria's offer of asylum.
Where do you see this dynamic going where international, you know, representatives should be brought to justice, whereas the president is saying that nobody should bring any pressure to bear on him for that?
No, I think my president is not being properly understood.
Yes.
You know, he gave an African proverb. And the proverb he gave over the BBC, and somewhere else which was repeated, was that if your house is on fire, you first put out the fire before you find out who set the house on fire. Then in the process, yes, and that is yes. And I think there is much wisdom in this. Because as I said in my remarks here, that President Charles Taylor, he has to realize, and I think he has realized that he is part of the problem, and he has to be part of the solution. He should know that by now, you know. So our attempt from Nigeria is to pull him out. You know, that's what it is. What you do after that?
It's your problem.
To what extent is Nigeria involved in the political negotiations currently underway in Ghana? And what role is Nigeria playing, and how is that role being manifested there in Accra?
Unfortunately, discussions of this type have to be done in sort of secret. But it is not usually to the detriment of parties or the Liberians. Because, you see, at meetings like this, you discuss strategies and tactics. You will realize that the man in charge of this, the chairman of the committee, is a former Nigerian head of state, General Abdul Salam Abubakar, a professional soldier. They are at the highest level, they are discussing tactics, and I don't think that they would want to come out and tell you that this is what they are planning.
Yeah.
They won't do that. But anyway, members or representatives of LORD and MODEL and other groups are represented. They are taking part in the negotiations going on. So what we know from outside is that a transitional government of national unity is being put in place. But come August 11th, and let your man, President Taylor, move out, then you will see what Accra has to produce or to show. I think we wait for this, because we can't discuss their strategies here. Yeah. But all we hear is that, well, either Lord or model is asking for particular ministries, you know. It's like the sort of thing you have across your border there with Ivory Coast. You know, people, you know, wanting to control the Minister of Internal Affairs or Interior or the Minister of Finance or Defense, you know, that sort of thing. But that is what they want us to hear on the outside. You see, so I think we leave that to them. Let us trust that they will do well. Anyway, the Nigerian former head of state there is impartial. And he is committed, you know, to the fact that a viable transitional government should be in place. After that, you can discuss your elections and referendums and take a look at your constitution and see what you can do. And go back to us, answer some of the very pertinent questions Professor here raised. And the man with a solid history about your country.
Mr. Ambassador, thanks for everything and thanks for being here. I want to ask you to please tell us and the body how ECOMOS will be supported in Liberia and who is the largest donor to the UN and ECOWAS.
That's a good question. That's a good one. Well, I think you Liberians abroad and those at home, when I made this, I'm thinking about the militia. Somebody that joined me at the interview yesterday put the figure of armed militia at about 1 million in Monrovia. I hope he's wrong. I mean, that's frightening. You know, and you have these kind of people walking around. So you have to talk to them. You must be, somehow they must be related. Somehow you must know some people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I mean. Because the peace that you are seeking, you have a part to play in it. Yes. You have a part to play in it. Even if we bring 5,000 troops from Nigeria, and you, without the support domestically from Liberians, things are not going to be that easy. And nobody wants to stay in there. That's what I mean. You know, as for the support, financial support, well, we are hearing that the UN is preparing to send a stabilization force with money. I don't know. But you know, the UN will also call on the deep pockets in the West too. So, but I think you in diaspora, Liberians in diaspora, you can also approach, you know, sources here within the U.S. It's a magnanimous country, you know, once they believe in your cause, they will come and give you your support. So I think great people like professors here and the rest here, and then let them articulate what you need and make sure that the money is going out to your people there to provide relief, food, medicine, and then they will come. I think you can do that. Nigeria, for my country, we are doing the angle that we can come in at this time. In the 1990s, we won't believe it. That when Nigeria came in first with Doe and the rest of the catastrophes that followed that, President Clinton, a former president of the United States during the African summit here in September 2000, announced to the whole world, I mean, in acknowledging, you know, Nigeria's contribution to peace in West Africa and the leadership that we have shown, that Nigeria on its own spent $10 billion. It's a pity that today we still don't have peace in your country. Yes, that's what he said. Check it with him. And it's an authoritative source, so you can't be mistaken about it. So, I don't think that this time round, let me not say this, we have our soldiers there. And let us see. But I believe that the international community will help. They will help.
His Excellency Augustine Agata, the Nigerian Deputy Ambassador to the U.S., speaking at a Coalition of Concerned Liberians meeting last week.
Hi, I'm Angelique Shofar, Associate Producer for Peace Watch. Although I am behind the scenes at Peace Watch, I look forward to the illumination and wealth of news and alternative views that it provides me on a daily basis. If you enjoy this program, please make a contribution to keep it alive. You can support us through our secured online website at www.pacifica.org or send in your check or money order made out to Pacifica Radio at 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We cannot continue without you.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.